Films in Canada is a based on a true story podcast about Canadian movies. I'm William.
And I'm Chris. Nice to be back, William.
It's great to be back. It's great to especially have you back. You don't want to try that joke again?
Is it fresh on the third time?
It only gets better. Okay. They only get better. Yeah. Okay. I didn't know what you're getting at the first time, so I totally misunderstood what you're doing. But today we're going to be talking about the Bill Miner story, as told by Canadian filmmakers. It is The Grey Fox from 1982. How you been? Like, anything you want to update us on for whatever reason?
I had a bit of a tornado of sadness touchdown in my life. So I was out of the loop for a little while, but I can tell you that movies are very therapeutic. So I found a lot of solace in movies, mostly comedies, mostly dumb things, you know, watching Step Brothers again, or things that make me feel good, like A League of Their Own, Bull Durham. It was fun to revisit films that you know will just scratch that itch, you know, make you feel better, make you laugh. So movies, now more than ever, always good therapy, as far as I'm concerned.
That's good to know. It's good to know. Yeah. Did you go to the familiar, or did you go to new in familiar territory?
No, I just went to the things I know are predictably great.
Okay.
Again, mostly comedies and mostly juvenile. Like, you know, old school Step Brothers, stuff like that.
Well, I'm glad you found some joy in those moments, and I do hope, as the days go by, I hope you feel better and better.
Yeah, thank you. I've missed you guys, and it's really nice to be back talking about movies. That was a big absence.
Yeah.
In the couple months I was gone, so it's good to be back.
Yeah, I agree. Not just because of your absence, but because I was busy with things. Alexander was busy with things.
Yeah.
Life just kind of gets in the way of the things we enjoy, it seems.
Yeah, agreed.
Yeah. So I'm hoping that we are going to continue this effort and find pleasure in it for a little while longer. Yeah. Okay, there's a couple things I want to talk about in terms of The Grey Fox. Mm-hmm. One is accessibility of the movie.
Yes.
And then the movie itself. And,
yes.
And then the history around the movie.
Mm-hmm.
So Chris, you suggested we talk about this because it was back in June or May that there was a special screening of The Grey Fox at the Cinematheque.
You should know this. It was Canadian Film Day. And what day is that, William?
April 19th.
That's the day. Mm. Yeah, so the Cinematheque did run a special screening of it for Canadian Film Day.
Okay. Not solely because of this reason. It was free. we talked about going.
Yes.
Yeah, but then I didn't end up going, and you did go. Part of the reason why I didn't go was a misunderstanding on my part, because in the write-up about it, I recall there was something that led me to believe it was getting a restoration.
Oh.
I feel a little bit spoiled when old movies are kind of given a bit more attention again, be it a restoration or a director's cut or a new DVD pressing or whatever. When that happens, like, these old movies, they become accessible. They might get a limited theatrical run, or they might end up on streaming, or there's a new DVD, etc.
Yep.
And so I just took it for granted that because they were doing a screening of The Grey Fox, that I would be able to just catch it whenever.
Yeah.
And that wasn't the case.
So wasn't.
You went to see it.
Yeah.
And you said we should talk about it. And then I spent a couple of weeks trying to source it.
Yeah, and you had told me that you couldn't find it. And we checked, I think between the two of us, we checked every library system in the Lower Mainland. And what made me mad is when I was doing research for this, it says Grey Fox has been designated and preserved as a, quote, masterwork by the Audiovisual Trust of Canada. But it is almost entirely unavailable. So what does that mean? Doesn't that mean that it is archived in a way that would allow viewers to see it?
Well, the thing about that, the Audiovisual Preservation Trust of Canada, is that it was a nonprofit effort to dedicate to promoting and preserving Canada's audiovisual heritage. They only ran from 2000 to 2007.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Sorry, I didn't have that information.
So in in, well, I guess at the end, 2007 or 2008, the Conservative government, federal government of Canada, that year eliminated 300,000 dollars of funding from the program, and that effectively canceled it.
So the Conservative government cut the arts?
Yes.
That is shocking.
Yeah. Huh. So that 2000 to 2007 was the run of that AV Preservation Trust of Canada.
Oh, that's really disappointing.
So they named several movies each year, and and some other, not just movies, like short films and video works and music works. They named them as things to be preserved, but then that just stopped. So it was like this this film preservation type of effort in Canada that went up in smoke because there's no funding for it. So
Very disappointing. That is disappointing. Yeah.
And I think at the time when there was a free screening as the Canada Film Day, I also saw that there was something called the Canada On Screen program, which was sponsored by TIFF, the Cinémathèque, Library and Archive Canada, Cinémathèque Québécoise, and that's it. Yeah, maybe some other kind of federal arts funding. But it was in 2017, which was Canada's 150th birthday year.
Right.
What's that fancy word?
Sesquicentennial.
I think so. I take your word for it. Yeah. There was like a big year-long tour of Canadian movies. And then sort of the ongoing legacy of that was they were going to name masterworks to this collection every year. So it was this living collection. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what I saw in the write-up for The Grey Fox, that the first new addition to this living list of masterworks was The Grey Fox.
I see.
But it turns out that that is just that's just words. it didn't mean anything.
May I ask how you watched Back to God's Country?
Through YouTube. It was actually a video posted by Library and Archives Canada.
Okay. I was just trying to think of, you know, things that are very obscure that I think would be part of this, you know, national treasures of Canadian film, something like that. It was, you know, one of our first feature films. I was just wondering how you watched it, because I tried every other format to watch or to find Grey Fox on your behalf, and I couldn't find anything.
Yeah, so there needs to be some sort of a body that would, like, take the effort to put it on a streaming service or whatever, right? But that doesn't exist. Anyway, so in the end, I ended up going to our friends at Black Dog Video.
Shout out to our friend Darren Gay.
And they had a copy in their store that was available. Not a like a totally commercially produced copy, but it was at least it was available. So I got it from Black Dog Video.
And I think the first time I saw it was in the 90s, and it was from the Vancouver Public Library. So I honestly can't say if it was on a VHS copy, because it was the mid-90s. So I saw it either on VHS or DVD from the library.
So the Cinémathèque screening that you attended, it was actually on a film print.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it had all the little cracks and pops and, you know, chicken in the gates and all those things that make film so delightful to look at. Looked great. Didn't look pristine. It just looked great.
Hmm. When was the last time you think you saw something projected from film?
When you and I saw that Jaws release, that was probably like 7 years ago.
Oh, right.
Was that on film?
It was, yeah.
Did we see Black Christmas on film?
That I'm not sure.
Okay. But the Jaws was film.
Okay.
That was another one of the movies I went to in my sadness was Jaws, which, like Tootsie, is to me a perfect movie. So it's a go-to that I go back to at least annually. So it hasn't been that long. I think because we're sort of, we go to the Van City and we go to the Cinémathèque maybe a little more frequently than your average person. I think we've had the advantage of seeing film a little more. And hey, you saw Quentin Tarantino's Hateful Eight on 70 mil.
Yes.
But not really.
Yeah, I saw it, yeah.
But not really.
That's a long story.
Yeah.
A long, sad story.
Yeah.
But the gist of it is that it was a shittily projected version of The Hateful Eight, and Cineplex when I complained to Cineplex, their position was, well, that's how it should look because it's on film.
Sure.
It should look shitty.
You got it.
Yeah.
Do you think Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is that shot on 35 mil?
I don't know. You saw it.
I saw it.
Yeah. I don't, at the end, they usually have different company logos.
Yeah, right? You're right. I didn't check. Hmm. It seems like Tarantino would shoot something like that on 35 mil, but...
Probably. Seems like that kind of a guy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway, back to The Grey Fox. All right. So it was released in 1982. The director was Philip Borsos, who was born in Tasmania, Australia. Yeah, and then died in Vancouver in 1995.
So young.
Yeah. Actually, as I was preparing my notes to talk about this, it kind of dawned on me that most of the people involved with this movie are dead.
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, it's kind of, and it's just, I don't know, it just really felt, well, but it came out in the 80s, which it seems like it was, you know, still within recent memory, the 80s to me, right? So it just seems weird that all the people who made this, not all, most of the people who made this are gone.
Yeah.
And then of course, the added fact that it was hard to source it. So it just seems like there's no one who will be around to remember this.
Right. Well, thank God that this podcast will live on forever.
In infamy. as long as we renew our URL.
Yeah, I was really interested to dig into Philip Borsos and his biography. I don't think I knew that much about him. So it was interesting to find out that he was a local and had gone to Vancouver Art School, which is now Emily Carr School of Art and Design, lived on Main Island, died of leukemia at 41, was nominated for an Academy Award for one of his short films, which is pretty exciting.
Mm-hmm.
And he directed a movie with my boyfriend, Kurt Russell, The Mean Season, which I didn't know that was Philip Borsos.
Oh.
I mean, I knew about Bethune, and I knew about Long Way From Home, The Adventures of Yellow Dog, which I adored. But I didn't know about The Mean Season.
Mm. Okay.
Which seems like something like a Michael Mann would have directed back in the 80s.
I'm not familiar with that one, but
oh.
Okay.
Did I mention it has Kurt Russell in it?
Yeah.
Yeah, that okay, part just remember. Making sure that you heard that.
did you know that he, toward the end of his career, he was working on a version of the Cider House Rules?
Is that right?
Yeah, but from what I read, he was actually filming it. But
really?
But he had to stop because his backers pulled out. So.
Wow.
And yeah, so he was 27 when he was directing The Grey Fox.
It's almost Spielbergian.
And I actually found a photo of him on set, which I thought.
Oh my God! Does he look like a kid?
Well, nearly. I mean, he does look like one of those 70s, 80s young adults who kind of dresses rattly.
Oh, for those of you that can't see this book in this medium, he looks like Burton Cummings meets Gabe Kaplan from Malcolm Back Cotter.
Yeah.
So he has a very delicious head of curly hair. That's fantastic. And the book that we're reading or looking at is Best Canadian Screenplays.
All right, so other people who were involved, screenwriter John Hunter. So he passed in 2015. Of course, Richard Farnsworth, he passed in 2000. He's an American. Jackie Burroughs passed in 2010. So originally from the UK, but she was a Canadian. Ken Pogue passed in 2015. Mm-hmm. Wayne Robson as Shorty passed in 2011. So
man,
we just go down that list. And yeah.
Wasn't there like a rumor around that John Wayne movie, Genghis Khan, that everyone got cancer because they shot the film near the Bikini Atoll or wherever they had nuclear testing or something like that? Is The Grey Fox cursed?
Well, I don't know if it's cursed. It's cursed by old age, I guess.
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah. So the story is based on Bill Miner, who's a real person. He was a stagecoach robber in the 19th century, and then he changed his career to train robber in the early 20th century. He's credited, arguably credited, as staging the first train robbery in Canada. Mm-hmm. And the year of that was?
1904.
Okay.
Because he saw the great train robbery in 1903, which inspired him to think about robbing this particular form of locomotion. Mm-hmm.
Which is proof that movies, violence in movies, influences real life.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it's a good thing he didn't have video games back then.
That's right.
But that stat is, it's a weird stat. It's like this historical fact that I think people kind of find a little bit endearing. But there's actually people who argue that that people robbed trains before that.
I couldn't seem to find proof of this, so it might be just apocryphal, but I remember maybe the first time I saw it, because he was called the Gentleman Bandit, because he was very polite and courteous, I had heard that he was the first person to say, put your hands up.
Right.
Did you read that or hear that in any of the research you did for this
podcast?
Well, at
the beginning of the movie it says that, right?
Okay.
Yeah. But okay. I think I read it in a book as well.
Okay.
Or on a Wikipedia page. So, yeah, right. He's credited as coining that phrase. Yeah. Mm. So something I gathered from that book you were holding, Best Canadian Screenplays, which came out in 1992. John Hunter, John Hunter, who wrote the screenplay, he credits Philip Borsos as the originator of the project. And so when John Hunter got on board, the movie had been in development for several years already.
Oh.
It had cycled through 5 different writers and 6 screenplays.
Whoa.
And what Hunter saw as the flaw to those screenplays was that it was too documentarian. That it was just a lot of the facts, but yeah, not enough heart.
Sure.
So what he injected was, he admits, the fictitious love affair.
Yeah, which I was heartbroken to discover was fictional. And a little later on, we could talk about maybe who that woman is based on, because I've done a little research.
Oh,
but,
nice. Okay.
I was just deflated. I wanted Kate and Bill to be a couple. I wanted them to have fallen in love in the autumn of their life. I loved their love story.
Well,
I'm just going to think that it was true in my brain.
Let's get back to that a little bit later, because that also speaks to like what you want from the movie versus what you want from history.
Right.
Yeah. So the love affair was like the big revelation in developing this story. And once that was approved, John Hunter wrote a new screenplay in 11 days.
Oh, wow.
Because they were in a rush to secure the shooting dates and get the investors and their main actor on board.
Gotcha.
And that main actor at the time was Harry Dean Stanton.
What?
But he eventually turned it down.
Huh. And then those guys went on to play brothers in David Lynch's The Straight Story, 25 years later.
Yeah.
Huh.
From that first draft to the end of production, John Hunter would make 3 more versions of the screenplay.
Wow. Yeah.
And the version that was in that book I was holding has slight differences from the final movie. So again, there's shooting script, and then in the editing process, they still make some changes.
Gotcha.
And as we talk about the movie, I'll point out what some of those things
I
noticed.
Oh, good. Yeah.
Yeah.
Exciting.
Yeah. But do you want to? Did you prepare like a plot synopsis to read to us?
Yeah, and just because I thought it was interesting. So let me start at the beginning. So Bill spends 30 years in San Quentin, and he's released in 1901. And he goes to visit his sister in Washington State, and he's going to try and go straight. He's going to try and be clean living, and I looked up the inventions that had happened in the 30 years that Bill was in San Quentin, because you have to realize he went to prison in the 19th century and was released from prison in the 20th century. Though the world is not as accelerated then as it is now, this is what happened, just, a snapshot of things that were invented while Bill was in prison, so he would have no idea. The Ferris wheel, the Tesla coil, the rotary dial, bottle caps. Get this one, zippers. So Bill went in with buttons, came out with zippers. Exciting. Cotton candy, the semi-automatic shotgun, and the flash lamp, which I think is nice because it ties in with the character of Kate Flynn. So that was used for photography. So it was igniting magnesium, doing blah, 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 I don't know, something science-y. So he comes out, tries to go clean for a couple years, has the most miserable job at an oyster farm somewhere in Puget Sound, which just looks like a totally shitty job, and it always seems to be raining. Sees the Great Train Robbery, which is a 12-minute short film, which is considered the first Western and the first American action film. And then gets inspired to rob a train, which he doesn't do successfully the first time, but does, I think, successfully the second time. And in order to escape the authorities, he settles in Kamloops, BC, and tries to go straight and pretend that he's an investor in the mine in that community. Mm-hmm. And then he falls in love with Kate Flynn, a feminist photographer. But can Bill stay straight? I don't think so.
He makes a good effort, though.
He sure does.
Yeah, and I think
I was rooting for him.
Yeah, and I think that's the key. I think that's the key is Richard Farnsworth's performance,
yeah,
where you want him to just like have a nice easy go at it.
Yes, please.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's interesting. Like, why does he? I guess like it's a thing he knows how to do. Robbing stagecoaches, robbing trains, but like we don't really see that he's trying to maintain a lifestyle that he needs a lot of money.
No, he's not. We don't see him in saloons, gambling,
yeah,
or you know, anything like that. He seems to have a sort of modest life. He does a little bit of horse wrestling, which I think generates some income.
It wasn't that the horse. Did you say wrestling?
Wrestling.
Wrestling.
And then as soon as I said it, I'm like, is that the word? I don't think we use that word.
What do you mean?
Much.
Does he break horses? Or does he... I thought he was...
He was stealing horses.
Yeah, he was stealing horses.
Yeah.
So again, it's like a criminal enterprise.
Right.
But he kind of like... He doesn't really want
casual.
To do it.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
It's because this guy is, hey, we're friends and like you owe me one. How about you do this for me?
Right.
Yeah. So yeah, again, it's just sort of he's good at what he does. And he'll do it, but I'm not really sure that he needs to. So when he meets Kate, it does feel like, oh, now he's, you know, this is probably what he should be doing and what he wants to do.
Right.
At least you want to believe.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And also that, like, the local constable gets along with him too.
Yeah.
Which I think, like, if you're going to hide out in town, I think it makes sense to be chums with the local police.
Why not?
You wouldn't be
hide
like,
in plain sight.
You wouldn't be get off my property. I have nothing to say to you. You'd be like, yeah, let's hang out.
Absolutely. And whoever played, I don't know the actor's name, who played the, well, I guess they weren't RCMP officers, whatever that sergeant at arms.
Yeah, Sergeant Fernie. That was Timothy Weber.
Yeah, just such a kind of sweet, dopey greenhorn. It was nice. It was a nice characterization of, you know, you're not going to send a hardened cop to Kamloops, BC in 1904, you know, so it's going to be some young rookie. And I thought that that actor played it really well. And they had a nice sort of avuncular relationship between mm-hmm. Bill and yeah. Sergeant Fernie.
So Bill Miner, his reputation is that he never killed anyone. And I think that helps us feel like we're, you know, we're on his side, we're rooting for him, right? Also, he and this one I guess it depends on what position you have on what he's doing, but he's also kind of built up as a Robin Hood figure because his position is that he's stealing from the rail company, which is stealing from regular people.
Right.
Yeah. And I don't think it comes across so well in the movie, but in some of the readings that I did.
I agree. Yeah. I didn't know that either, that the CNR or whatever version of the CNR was happening at that time was unlikable.
Yeah. Because
yeah.
One of the things I read was when after he got arrested and he was being shipped back to New Westminster.
Right.
That a crowd actually lined the streets to greet him because they felt he was kind of like a local folk hero.
Right, right.
Yeah. So that doesn't really translate into the movie, but So, you know, whether it's like a victimless crime or not, that kind of adds to his likability, right?
Right.
Yeah. It'd be very different if he was like a violent criminal, if he was, if he was menacing.
Right.
But he's not.
And I think that the haul that he got that allowed him to settle in Kamloops, or, you know, sort of hide in Kamloops, it was $7,000.
Oh, wow.
Which to me seems like a lot of money.
I think so.
In 1904? Yeah. I feel like I realize he split it with Shorty or whatever, but still, that seems like a pretty good haul.
Well, he knew what he was doing. But then, so that was like his last job until they dragged him back in.
I think after I saw this and then I had a chance to talk with you again, I said that Farnsworth's performance was one of the most authentic, deep, easy performances I think I've ever seen on screen. And I had thought that in the 90s when I saw the movie, and then, you know, all this time has passed and it seemed even richer and easier than it did 25 years ago. It is a performance of a lifetime.
He wasn't, at the time, he wasn't considered like an A-list actor. I don't know if he ever was, but...
No, I think he just was a stunt guy, you know?
But at this time, when he made this movie, was he getting like big roles like this?
No, I think this was his first leading man role.
Yeah. And he was not the first choice. So...
Yeah.
I think he wears this role like a glove.
Ebert says that Farnsworth's performance is unstudied, graceful, and absolutely natural. And I would say that that is pretty damn accurate. Mm-hmm.
The other thing about the movie is that I like that it doesn't feel showy. Mm-hmm. Like it feels like it has a limited budget, but all the money is on screen. Mm-hmm. Like it just doesn't feel like there's any excess.
No.
Whether it's in like the art direction, or whether it's in trying to get beautiful locations, or
the locations were dynamite.
Oh, they're fantastic.
Wow.
Yeah. Not because they look more spectacular than they need to look. They just look like they're real.
They look lived in, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah.
There's no artifice.
Yeah. Like the towns that we see, they feel like they existed at the time. Mm-hmm. They don't feel like just facades on a backlot. And then all the other performances, all the supporting performances, none of them seem like they arrive to really show up the story or take over a scene. It looks like they're all there to support this feel of this one story. Like everything just feels of a piece, and right. It just everything belongs, and it just there's an elegance to it that makes it feel kind of timeless
and rare. I mean, I think we've had a lot of beefs with Canadian film because either the acting is wooden or the production values make it look like a cheap, you know, CBC series. I think the word elegant is really accurate. I think that really transmits the flavor of this film. It was shot in Fort Steele, so it was the first production to ever be permitted to shoot in historic Fort Steele.
Where's that?
It's in British Columbia.
Oh, yeah, that one, yeah. No, do you know why?
I'm very
bad
at geography.
Do you know why it was like...
Paul has been there, so it must be close to the Kootenays, mm-hmm. So like Castlegar Trail, because he went there on a school field trip when he lived in Grand Forks, BC, in the Kootenays. So I'm going to say it's about 8 hours from here. Mm. Grand Forks is 7, so somewhere.
But do you know why it was hard to get?
Because it's historic and it's not meant to be, you know... Mm. It's not meant to have 200 people on a film production messing things up. Like, it's a preserved historic town, like Dawson City.
You mean Dawson's Creek?
Whatever the one is, you know what I'm talking about. I always mix those two up.
Okay. Okay, well...
I don't think that anyone else subsequently has been able to, like, you're not going to be able to shoot Deadwood the movie at Fort Steele. I think they said, we're going to give you dispensation to do this one feature, but we need to keep the town as it is.
Okay. Also, the trains in the movie. I don't know. I
Where
love
those
trains.
Come from? How
I love trains
that
in movies. They just it seems like it might not, it's probably not an easy thing to work with. And you know, you can only get so many angles on it.
Oh my God, that thrilling scene when the horse, they're trying to, I think when they're still horse wrestling and they're trying to beat the train before the horses.
Oh, right.
Jesus, I almost had a heart attack. Like, how do you shoot that on a $4.5 million budget? It looked thrilling. And you're working with a train. I don't even know how you do that. That was just so impressive. Amazing stunt riding, thrilling shots. I loved that scene. Oh, and about Farnsworth's performance, which, I mean, I could talk about all day. There's a scene where he comes across Kate Flynn playing golf in Kamloops. I think this is when he's just riding into town for the first time. And he's riding his horse, just walking along. Golf ball goes in front of him, and he backs the horse up so that he can identify what this thing was that came out of the sky. Mm-hmm. And the way he backs up the horse was with such ease. It was like he'd been doing it. It was like what the horse was a part of him. It'd be like you just backing up and with your feet. I can't explain how graceful that move was, but I know he's a horseman and a stunt person from, you know, 40s and 50s, but his ease on a horse was just poetry. It was so beautiful to watch. I mean, horses are huge, intimidating, and capricious, and he just made it look so easy. Like, it was just a part of him.
There's that moment where he steals a horse to get out of town. When it cuts from the transition, it's a hard cut between him like looking at the horse, thinking, should I take it?
Yeah.
And then he's in a full gallop on like this ridge. Wow. It was a great hero shot. And I was just like, this guy just looks like he's in his element.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And you have to think that Farnsworth, I assume, was in his late 50s, early 60s.
At least, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So move over, Tom Cruise.
Now, okay, so one of the things about the way that Miner's characterized in the movie, did you feel that he was, we talked about it, where he doesn't seem like he needs to go into a life of crime, except mm-hmm. that he doesn't know what to do.
Right.
Seems like he has some pressure on him later to do these things. It's expected of him, right? One of the differences in the between the screenplay and the final edit is when he buys the gun. So it seemed, if I remember correctly, in the movie, it's like we're like well into the second act, I think, before he buys his gun.
Yeah.
Right? So in this, and why does he do that exactly? Is when he was going to leave Washington and go mm-hmm. to go elsewhere, and it seems like he just wanted some extra protection at that time, right? He'd already had the encounter in the bar with that guy who recognized him from prison.
Right, yes.
Yeah, and he proves himself pretty capable, mm-hmm. I think. Yep. Oh, no, maybe I have that the wrong way around.
Oh, did he already have the gun?
He did have a gun, yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Okay, maybe I have that wrong way around. Anyway.
They have one of Bill Miner's guns at the Kamloops Museum and Archives, so next time you're in the Okanagan, stop by that museum and you'll get to see Bill Miner's gun.
Interesting. Well, anyway, just the thing that I just wanted to say was, so in the screenplay, as soon as he gets out of prison, he buys a gun.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. So in that characterization, there's something about Bill Miner's history that
he's burned someone in the past, or he feels like he might have a target on his back from being a criminal for.
Maybe, yes. Yeah, that's an interesting look at it, too. But very early on, he feels like he's going to be a tough guy in a rough world. Whereas in the movie, it seems like he comes out optimistic that he can just, I'm just going to get a regular job and just do my thing, right?
Right.
So anyway, that's something I noticed. Mm-hmm. What do you think of that scene where, I think it's Christmas, and the sergeant asks Kate to come photograph the crime scene. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yes.
At the Chinese labor camp.
Yeah,
there's a murder-suicide.
Mm-hmm.
It's an interesting episode in the movie. And then why does and Bill doesn't seem like he is entirely comfortable at the crime scene because mm-hmm. he's not a murderer. He's not used to seeing dead bodies. But he asks the sergeant, "Can I?" When the sergeant says, "I'm going to go ride and see if I can find the guy who did this,"
right?
And he says, "Can I come with you?" What did you have any impressions with that whole sequence? Like it's an interesting glimpse at the world because we've just seen it through Bill's eyes so far, and
right.
it looks like it's white settlers
right.
doing the thing,
yeah.
And then we see this side of life where it's you know, immigrant laborers. Something is deeply unsettled about their condition. So
I thought it was quite. I mean. We've seen, like, especially something like Porky's, we've seen some, you know, racism and homophobia in movies that we've rewatched from, you know, the 80s, 90s. I thought it was treated with such tenderness, like, of course this would be hard. You're away from everybody.
Well, that's what Bill says.
Yeah, well, I was so yeah. moved by that. I'm like, yeah. in a time, in 1904 and in 1982, when you could be cruel and dismissive and racist, Bill was just thoughtful, and it was very tender-hearted.
Mm-hmm. Which is interesting, because he makes this connection about, like, you know, don't be too, you know, don't try to, sorry. Like, the sergeant says, I don't know what goes on in these people's heads, pretty much.
Right.
And Bill says, you know, don't have that attitude. These people are a world away from home.
Right.
Coming from a guy who spent half of his life in prison.
Yeah.
And he's also on the run. So, like, he doesn't have a home either.
Oh, that's a nice observation.
But he seems to sympathize with the fact that if you're not at home, that you're not going to be content.
Right.
Right. And so maybe that kind of lines up with why his meeting with Kate instills in him this new feeling of like maybe he should settle down.
Right.
Yeah. Anyway, just a thought.
Yeah. No, that's a good observation. Which you think would compel him to nest with Kate and not have any second doubts about it. I have a home.
Except that the threat of going to prison means that they would be separated.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I did like that detail of when the Pinkerton detective visits the corporal. Sergeant? Fernie.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, he's kind of he's trying to they're trying to determine like who has jurisdiction. I did like the detail that, you know, they were saying you know, you have to report back to New Westminster because that's where the
right.
capital of BC was at the time.
Yeah. Yeah. Isn't there a local celebrity that lives in New West? William Lee, who does the podcast Film to Canada?
I don't think he's been embraced in New West yet.
No.
Though he embraces New West.
It's funny that, you know, the photo of Bill Miner that we're all familiar with, that the Grey Fox poster is based on. When I was living in Victoria in the 80s, the Keg had murals of Bill Miner all over. So right. I had seen that photo in like 1985. Of course, I didn't know anything about the movie in 1985. But the woman who plays Kate took that photo, and it was essentially one of the first kind of mugshots. She was considered BC's first photojournalist because she was recording these criminals like that. She was taking photos behalf of the Vancouver Province or Sun, like one of the early local papers here.
Let me get this straight. So Kate is a real life person?
Yeah.
You were saying that she's inspired by a real life person?
That's yeah, that she's at. There's no such person. Her name's Mary Spencer.
Okay. And Mary Spencer is actually shot that photo of Bill
yeah.
Miner. Really?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Isn't that wild?
It is, yeah.
Yeah. And is that a picture that you have been familiar with?
Yeah. Because also I conflate that with that final image in The Great Train Robbery.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
Yes, you're right.
For a long time, I thought they were one and the same.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Agreed.
Okay. So that's very interesting. That's something that John Hunter did, is he took a real person in Bill's life and then made this fictitious version for the movie. That's
mm-hmm.
That's very clever.
And she really came from St. Catharines, Ontario. She did settle in Kamloops. She did have her own photography studio. She wasn't a feminist. She was very soft-spoken. And she died in Summerland at the age of 81.
Oh, okay.
So that's kind of interesting. Yeah.
Speaking of the keg, which is that like limited to BC, the keg, or is it elsewhere? But it's like this, it's a steakhouse.
Yeah, it is in Alberta now.
Okay.
But I think it was born here.
All right. Have they always been having, I guess like because it's a BC chain, they have like BC history on their walls and stuff.
Yeah.
That's why Bill Miner.
I think
okay.
so.
Okay. I didn't make the connection until last night.
Oh.
That the,
you were at the keg?
No. Oh. No, we only go there on somebody's birthday because because you get a free slice of Billy Miner pie.
Of course you do. I remember that.
Yeah. I didn't make that connection that's why it was named Billy Miner pie.
Right.
Which is delicious, by the
way. It's like a mud pie, right?
Kind of like, yeah, it's like it's creamy and it's got some ice cream and it's got some chocolate and oh yeah, it's good.
Wow, can't wait for my birthday.
Yeah. But did you, because you went to the keg all the time, you knew that already?
It's because they would serve us underage. So we started going there at 15 and wearing a lot of makeup so that we could order fuzzy navels.
Yeah. So Billy Miner is just like adopted into BC history because he spent so much time here and he robbed the CPR, right? So,
yeah, when I found out he was born in Kentucky, I'm like, hey, wait a second, because we have claimed him as our own for sure.
Yeah. So the ending of the movie, you want to talk about the ending of the movie?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, do you have other points you wanted to talk about?
You were just talking about the screenplay being slightly different than what we see on screen. The screenplay does actually take lines of dialogue directly from court transcripts and testimonies of the time.
Oh, okay.
So I think that in those earlier versions when John Hunter was saying it feels too much like a documentary, I think because maybe in initial versions it really was more transcript than
right
dialogue.
Yeah. Well, I think the way that he talks, Bill Miner, I mean, it could be just that you build that performance or it's inspired by something. And so I guess if he had that sort of formalness to the way he talks, that, I mean, I think that adds to this this mystique of him as the gentleman bandit, right?
Right.
Yeah, so tripping over my words. Yeah, sorry. Getting a little bit tired. Gentleman bandit.
You want to talk about the ending?
Okay, let's talk about the ending. So the screenplay ending that's in that book, so which was the third draft of John Hunter's screenplay, which was a shooting script.
Okay.
So Bill Miner is arrested by the Northwest Mounted Police.
Right.
And then I think it goes to, if I recall correctly, it goes to a title card that says he escaped.
Right.
Years later. Or did they actually? No, maybe they intended to film the escape from the BC prison, but then goes to a title card that says he then continued robbing trains in Georgia and was sent to prison again, and that's where he died in prison, which is closer to the truth.
Yeah.
So he died in prison, but the movie that we see doesn't do that.
Right. I don't want him to die in prison. I want he and Kate to be in Europe. Don't you?
It is. It's strongly suggested, right? At the end of this movie, it's strongly suggested that they escape to Europe.
Yes.
Which is nice. This is a nice thought.
I'd like to think that's, yeah, that's where I'm going to say
they
ended their days together. Yeah.
They don't put it so definitively to say Billy Miner escaped. They say Kate went to Europe and a rich gentleman went with her.
Right.
Yeah. Which is nice. It's just a nice thought. Yeah.
Yeah. And of course, the person on which Kate is based never left the Okanagan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So some leaps in truth there. Yeah. But sometimes you want a movie to just tell you that it worked out okay.
Yeah.
If you like the character, right?
I don't always need a bow, but this is, I need these two people to be happy. I need them to be safe.
So I guess we feel it was the right decision by Philip Borsos.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
It's interesting how Grey Fox and My American Cousin are sort of tangentially related in that Grey Fox was the first BC feature film to get funding from Telefilm, and Borsos was instrumental in getting a Telefilm to set up an office in BC. And the success of the Grey Fox helped Sandy Wilson get funding, and the producer of Grey Fox also produced My American Cousin. Mm-hmm. And I would say two of the best BC movies that you've talked about on the podcast, that we've talked about.
Oh, I thought you were just going to say ever.
Maybe. Mm-hmm. I love both those movies. Mm-hmm. That's very exciting that his success helped her to have success for those movies. And they're both strong, great movies with a great regional feel, micro budgets, but look great.
This was sort of the start of the BC film mm-hmm. industry in mm-hmm. terms of like being like a like an actual like a regular production center. Right? Mm-hmm. I think there was like smaller movies that happened to be in BC before that, but now there was like this infrastructure to support it. And it's interesting that it seems like the early 80s there was like BC's auteur period.
Yeah.
And we quickly went from that to just the service industry for American TV shows.
Yeah, we don't have a lot of homegrown. I mean, I think we did in the 90s. You and I have talked about the Bruce Sweeneys and the Lynn Stopkowicz's. And so I think there was another wave 15 years later, mid to late 90s of
that's stuff. Almost like the like in the American model. Like when you hit the 70s and you have the like Spielbergs and Lucases, they would be like the film school generation who were trying to emulate what they learned.
The French New Wave.
From French New Wave.
Yeah, for sure.
And it seems like this, and then the French New Wave, of course, they were reacting to like a very traditional type of cinema as well. So in terms of like Canada's film history, where would these guys lie? Like, they're not, because these guys, like Sandy Wilson, though she did go to film school, I was going to say, like, she's not really, maybe they're not really peers in that case. What am I trying to say? Again, I'm trying to say nothing by saying too much. I don't know what I'm trying to say. I'm just saying, like, they seem like the pioneers.
Agreed.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you want to talk about what kind of awards this movie won?
Yeah.
Boy, it swept. For the Genies, it won Best Picture, Best Director. I like this. Best Foreign Actor, because Richard Farnsworth isn't Canadian. Yeah. Best Supporting Actress for Jackie Burroughs, Best Original Screenplay, Best Art Direction, and Best Musical Score. As soon as I heard the first notes of the score, I'm like, huh, it sounds like the Chieftains. And I think that it is some of the people from the Chieftains. And I thought the score was really effective. It had that slightly old-timey, Celtic-infused. I just thought it was really effective.
It's the kind of music that makes you appreciate a rainy day in the woods.
Yeah.
That's what I was feeling. Yeah. All right, I think we're wrapping up this talk. This is the point where we find a point of comparison to this movie.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Would you compare it to a Western, like an Unforgiven? I'm sorry, I haven't seen Meek's Cut Off, though you did lend me that DVD, so my apologies for not returning it.
Kind of like a revisionist. Is it a revisionist Western?
I think so.
Yeah?
I think so.
Or is it a heist movie? Is it a crime movie?
I like your revisionist history better.
But I don't know if it's like Unforgiven, because that's strictly about a gunslinger, right?
Yeah, okay.
This one is more about... this one has more nuance than that one, in terms of like this character who lives in that world. He's not in the same kind of mean world. Do you think this is an action movie?
No, I don't.
Yeah, I think that's what makes it different from
Westerns
for me.
It's like a gentle revisionist history romance. So you know, there's tons of movies in that genre.
Yeah, but most Westerns don't have the romantic angle.
No.
So I think it's more of like the gangster reformed genre.
Okay.
Which is which is like,
oh boy,
oh no, it's It's the reformed criminal. It's also the older character romance.
Yeah.
It's Jackie Brown.
Fucking A. You did it. You did it. You know what's funny? Okay, that is so odd that you said that. Because this morning when I was thinking about recording this podcast and thinking about the ease with which Farnsworth inhabits this character, I'm like, it's kind of like Robert Forster. You know, like everything Forster does, people might think it's one note, but to me, whether he's in The Descendants or What They Had or Jackie Brown, he's perfect as that character. I never see the seams. I never see Forrester acting. To me, he just is that person. Though I know that's doing him a disservice. But same with Farnsworth. Like, there's just an ease to their delivery and how they move through scenes and interact with actors. That it's funny that, yeah, when he played Max Cherry and Jackie Brown.
But that's the trick.
Amazing.
But that's the skill, is that it looks effortless.
Right.
Yeah. Okay, well, that's the point of comparison.
Okay.
Yeah. These are both movies that I like a lot then.
Me too.
And if Jackie Brown is my 0 point, I think The Gray Fox is...
Oh boy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Apples and apples. I don't know.
It's like plus one. It's like pretty close for me.
Agreed. I agree with that.
Okay. Do you like Gray Fox a little bit more than Jackie Brown?
A little bit.
All right.
My nephew got to see Jackie Brown with Pam Grier in the audience at the TIFF Bell Center in Toronto, and he's a flight attendant, so he just loved it. He said it was one of the most special things he's ever done, was to be in the audience and have Pam Grier talk about making the movie afterwards. That would be pretty cool.
Wow. That sounds like good programming at that place.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah, I say that because it seems like TIFF are the people that own this archival 35mm print of The Gray Fox.
Right.
And they should maybe tour it around a bit or something.
Yes, please. Yeah. Imagine if they did like a special filming in like Fort Steele and then Kamloops and, Victoria, yeah.
Like maybe New 20, Westminster. 30 people could see it at a time. They should... No, somebody just has to make like a DVD pressing of it, or
maybe we'll talk to the Keg. We'll see if the Keg will endorse this idea, give us some funding.
Anyways, okay, let's get that slice of Billy Minor pie.
Sounds great. Happy birthday to us.
Thanks for listening.